This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. This year marks the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, an event that shaped the history of the 20th century. Josh Sanborn is a historian at Lafayette College and the author of several books about Russia, including Imperial Apocalypse, The Great War, and the Destruction of the Russian Empire. Josh Sanborn, welcome to Worldviews.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'm really interested in this topic, 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. You've got an interesting perspective, but let's kind of get this little historical background maybe set up for us on kind of what was happening at that time, early 20th century, when the Great War, the First World War, was coming to an end and the Russian Revolution was heating up and kind of overlapping a little bit here. Can you kind of give us some historical context?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, World War I was an intensely traumatic event for all of Europe and for all of the world, really, but especially so in Eastern Europe. This was a territory that was controlled by big land empires, by the Russian Empire, by the Austro-Hungarian Empire, by the German Empire, by the Ottoman Empire. And as a result, these were sort of vulnerable states to massive social dislocation. And that's exactly what happened over the course of the war. The war really helped to unhinge the societies in those old empires and to transform them politically. So the best way to think about what's happening in Eastern Europe over the course of the war is to think of this as kind of a period of decolonization in Europe. We think of decolonization usually in terms of Africa and Asia in the post-World War II period. But what's happening in Europe in the midst of World War I shares a lot of similarities with that other process. So you start out with big empires, and at the end of the war, you have a number of new national independent states. You've got Poland, Czechoslovakia, you've got Latvia, Lithuania. You know, you've got a number of those new states. And so one way to look at what's happening in the revolution is to think about the revolution as one of the things that's happening in this really huge tectonic process of the end of these very old, venerable empires. And the Russian Revolution is one manifestation of that larger imperial collapse that's happening all over Eastern Europe.
Well, I want to get to the specifics of the revolution in a minute, but I just want to pick up on something you said when you refer to massive social dislocation and the unhinging of society. What do you mean by that specifically? The kind of stratification, the socioeconomic system, politics, I mean, kind of everything together. Can you give us some specifics?
Yeah, so I'll give some specifics from the Russian case, for instance. So a number of things start happening as early as 1914. The Russian state imposes martial law on the entire western sector of the empire and starts engaging in ethnopolitics. They deport large numbers of Germans and of Jews to the interior of the empire for suspicion of espionage. They try to institute a new sort of martial law economy where they fix prices, they requisition goods at prices underneath their value, and this really breaks the borderland economy. And so you start to see real economic troubles emerging within months of the war in wartime Poland, Ukraine, Belarus, these regions that are in the midst of the war. So that's one part of it. The second part really begins in 1915. The Russian army suffers one of the largest defeats in the war in 1915 as a result of a joint Austro-German invasion in April and May in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains that forced a retreat of Russian troops from all of Russian-occupied Poland and from much of Ukraine. This sets off a refugee crisis of gigantic proportions, about 3 million people over the course of 1915 alone, and about 6 million Russian subjects become internally displaced people over the course of the war. So that's a large number of people that have to come back and be resettled and be supported. Many of them come back, obviously, impoverished. Many of them come back that are ill. You start to see widespread of epidemic diseases, cholera, typhus. And the military defeat itself calls the Tsarist leadership into question. So there's an enormous political crisis in the summer of 1915. So that's when I talk about the unhinging of society. We're seeing brand new social groups, refugees, soldier wives that hadn't really formed before, now becoming very important features in the Russian political and social scene.
Really interesting to hear you talk about ethnopolitics and refugee crises. It sounds very similar to today, 100 years later. And we're going to get to that, perhaps, what some of the historical legacies are for today. But let's talk specifically about the revolution itself. Can you remind us about some of the major players, some of their goals? What were they trying to accomplish and what the major implications were of this this revolution?
Sure. So the Russian Revolution of 1917 is a year-long process with two sort of bookends to it, very famous bookends. The first one in February and March of 1917 is the revolution that unseats the Tsar, that ends the Romanov dynasty. That's led basically by street protests, not by any socialist parties and not by any famous revolutionaries that anyone knows. These are basically, they're led by urban women who are protesting the war and the conditions in which they're living, which were quite terrible in Petrograd, but really all throughout Europe. There's widespread hunger in Berlin and Vienna. Urban women are suffering throughout the continent. And so it's sort of a logical place for these street protests to start, but they blossom quite quickly. So over the course of 10 days, 2 weeks, the political crisis in Petrograd grows to the extent that the Tsar is forced to abdicate. The problem with that is that there's no government to replace him. And so you enter a period over the course of the entire year where the very nature of who's in authority in Russia is up for grabs. And there's two basic contenders for this. Elected politicians. There was a Russian parliament. And so the leaders of that parliament asserted a certain amount of authority. But also working class leaders from socialist parties through the urban Soviets. Soviets, just a Russian word for council. And so these were city councils basically run by workers. So that's the first bookend. You have a continuing political and social and economic crisis over the course of 1917 that radicalizes Russian society. It polarizes Russian society. And it means that the extremist parties are more likely to succeed in those conditions. So by the time you get to October, November of 1917, the most radical left-wing party, the Bolsheviks, the most radical of the communist parties in Russia, have been able to assert themselves in these Soviets and to have great influence among the troops, and that's enough of a base for them to basically launch a coup to unseat the provisional government based of these parliamentarians and to assert that all power in Russia was going to be in the hands of Soviets that they controlled.
So this is such an interesting story you're telling, and I'm thinking back to my, you know, study. I'm pulling out from the back of my brain the history that I you know studied years ago about this. And of course, when you hear many people talk about, the Russian Revolution, you always name names, and you haven't named any names.
Yeah.
I mean, you know that there's like this image of what Lenin was doing and Trotsky's role, and how Marxist thought was relevant here. And what you're telling me here, I'm particularly compelling. Street protests, the role of urban women, the fact that there were these elected officials, and an actual coup that happened—a very different picture. Can you tell me why?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's. We teach history through individuals for a lot of reasons, some of them good, some of them not so good. I mean, I think people do latch onto histories more when they can attach them to particular people and personalities that they can understand. And these are titanic figures. I mean, Lenin is a world historical figure. Trotsky is a very charismatic and compelling figure, both to his contemporaries and to historians. And they had great influence. I mean, I think absent Lenin and Trotsky, the Bolsheviks probably would not have succeeded, you know. But they didn't create the crisis that they took advantage of. I guess that's one way of putting it, is that the crisis was created by much larger forces, but they were able to take advantage of that crisis for their own party's political gain. And so, yeah, Lenin and Trotsky are very important. And so too is Marxist thought. I mean, there's a reason that communism becomes appealing to Russians in the middle of 1917 that has to do with the economic crisis in which they live. And it has to do with social polarization. By the time you get to the end of 1917, most regular Russians, peasants, workers, others, blame the elites in their society for what has occurred to them, both for the war, which they see as being alien to their interests, and for the economic crisis that they think they're being taken advantage of by the rich who are profiting from the war while they suffer.
I want to talk about some of the work that you've done. A very interesting title of a book, Drafting the Russian Nation, because it's specific to military conscription during this early period of the 20th century. You know, how that and massive war and mass politics all kind of come together, as you said, to create these forces that then individuals came in and perhaps took advantage of or capitalized on. So can you talk about the military conscription part of that and kind of how that plays into this as well?
Yeah, sure. That book was an attempt to come to terms with what nationalism meant in early 20th century Russia. There is still, I think, a notion that nationalism was sort of the property of the right wing in Russia in a certain way. And I was trying to expand that notion of what nationalism was and to use military conscription as a way to think about the ways that regular Russians, especially if you imagine some peasant from a far off village, how do they get integrated into a modern Russia, a mass political Russia? There's a number of ways that could happen through schooling and other ways. But the major way it happens in Russia is through military conscription. That's where they enter the nation in a certain way. And that had all kinds of consequences. It meant that the Russia that was built was actually, in many respects, multi-ethnic, not simply ethnically Russian, because Russia was an empire. So you had Ukrainians, you had Kazakhs, you had others in this army that you're serving alongside. So it was a multi-ethnic nation that they were building. But it also meant that the practice of violence was at the heart of being a citizen. And this is one of the things that is true in many regimes with universal military conscription, is that the prerequisite to being a citizen is the willingness to commit violence for the nation and to suffer violence for the nation, obviously, too. And so that, I saw that as having real consequences later into the 20th century when you ask why it is that officials acting under Stalin's orders, but obviously Stalin doesn't do all the killing under Stalin personally. He does very little of it. It's other people that are doing it. What leads them in collectivization or in the Great Terror or in World War II to have this capacity for mass violence? I saw a lot of that coming out of both the conscription regimes and the experience of total war beforehand. So the other aspect of that, of course, is that the Bolsheviks, who are seen as anti-national because they promoted communist internationalism, actually used nationalism as a way to consolidate sort of a civic community in Russia, and they did so quite consciously. So that was what that book was largely about.
So now we're going to pick up on some of these perhaps mm-hmm. common themes as we maybe bring you mm-hmm. from the early 20th century to maybe closer to today in the early part of the 21st century. So these themes, issues of nationalism, integration, trying to manage a multi-ethnic society, a Soviet empire that brought together all of these different types of peoples and languages and cultures and backgrounds. You know, if you, on the one hand, you have to think this is a very unstable place, right, throughout the 20th century, but it isn't necessarily the case. They all fought, a second Great War. They fought even a more destructive, more traumatic Second World War, lost even more people. How are we to kind of make sense of all of Russian history here over the past 100 years to understand Russia today?
Yeah, it's a good question. So Russia is a large multinational state. So from in the early 20th century and still today, there are many ethnicities that are living within the Russian Federation and had lived in the Russian Empire and lived in the Soviet Union. And so ethnic issues are always going to be important, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's unstable ethnically. And really, it was not ethnic nationalism that broke up the Soviet Union. It fractured along ethno-national lines when it collapsed. But really, it was state collapse rather than national crisis, a nationalist crisis that occasioned that. And I make the same argument about the Russian Revolution of World War I, that it's really the collapse of the state that generates a lot of the instability rather than sort of nationalist conflict that's happening there. And I think we can think about that in a similar way with contemporary Russia, too. If you think about the primary problems that both that the Russian state has faced since 1991 under both Yeltsin and Putin, the crisis of the state is primary among them. The collapse of the Soviet state was an extremely traumatic event that led to large-scale social problems. The 1990s were Russia experienced a larger depression than we experienced here in the 1930s. So it was a massive, massive loss of economic wealth and a state that had trouble functioning. And Yeltsin was a figurehead for that, and he was an erratic, chaotic, often drunken individual, and that that sort of exacerbated this problem for Russians. And they came to see, too, that in order to have prosperity and security, you needed a well-functioning state. And so Putin came to play that role, I think, quite effectively in the early 21st century. He's famously a sober individual, a disciplined individual. He focused on building state capacities, and they saw economic growth quite quickly, not simply because of Putin's actions. Oil prices played a role in that too, of course. But when people ask why Putin is popular in Russia, I think you have to understand that strengthening the state doesn't necessarily mean creating a Stalinist state. It means creating the conditions by which Russians might possibly be prosperous. Now, that has come with negative consequences too, of course. And those are ones that Russians, as well as people outside observers, are quick to note. It's easy for strong states to become authoritarian ones. And that's a danger that Russia faces today and has faced in its past.
So very quickly, just as we finish up, because I'm gonna push you on this point of individuals, and that is we tend to see Putin and the state as one. I mean, that's just kind of the perception. Is Russia's future really all about, will it always be about, given this history that you've so nicely described, about strong leadership in order to prevent that state collapse because of the major complexities? Is the strong leader really, really important? And we're going to finish there.
Sure. I actually think it's state institutions that are most important. Putin is tremendously important right now because the entire system kind of the elite system revolves around him. If he weren't there, there'd be elite conflict within society, within the political system, and that would be deeply damaging. But really, the big question for them is how do you stabilize and have high functioning state institutions? And so Putin is important in that, but. It's really important for Americans to recognize that even if, you know, Putin were to disappear tomorrow, Russia would not fundamentally transform. They're going to face the same economic, political, social, and global issues that they face today, and many people would solve them in similar ways to that Putin would. So it's not as if there's one dictator that tells everyone what to do. There's a functioning society and political system that is supportive of what Putin is doing right now.
Very important point. Thank you so much, Josh, for being here today. Really interesting history. Thanks.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It's a real pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Josh Sanborn. He's a historian at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlatt.